Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Last week, President Barack Obama said he would ask Congress to approve at least $50 billion to invest in the first year of a six-year process of remaking the nation's roads, railways, and runways. Joining us in a few minutes, we hope, is U.S. Secretary of Transportation Ray LaHood. He's going to talk about those plans and more. Let's hear from the president right now. Let's see. He was in during his Labor Day speech in Milwaukee. President Obama said America needs to rebuild its infrastructure.
Over the next 6 years, we are going to rebuild 150,000 miles of our roads. That's enough to circle the world six times. That's a lot of rope. We're going to lay and maintain 4,000 miles of our railways, enough to stretch coast to coast. We're going to restore 150 miles of runways, and we're going to advance a next-generation air traffic control system to reduce travel time and delays for American travelers.
Welcome back. That was President Barack Obama on Labor Day talking in Milwaukee, and I think joining us now, I hope, is Secretary LaHood. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you for having me, and thanks for your interest in what we're doing here.
Well, we're always interested in this topic in Ohio, where we have lots of roads and runways and that sort of thing. How can the nation afford even an initial $50 billion investment these days?
Well, because it is an investment. When we invest in the repair of roads or the construction of bridges, when we invest in transit systems, when we invest in high-speed rail, we're investing in jobs for people who pay taxes. And we have to make these investments. Otherwise, our infrastructure in America will continue to decay. The one thing that people want in America is good transportation, whether it's roads, rails, or runways. And these investments are not only investments in the infrastructure, but in the people who are on the job building the infrastructure, and these folks pay taxes.
In Ohio, top lawmakers have already said that they can't support or they don't want to support taking the federal money that's already been put out there from last year for high-speed rail, partly because they think it won't be high-speed enough, partly because people won't use it, and also because of the expected long-term reliance on state subsidies to keep the passenger rail going.
Well, look, at the people that are currently in office have accepted the money. I have been to Ohio, I think, maybe six or seven times.
Mm-hmm.
And every time I come there and every time I see the governor and every time I see his Secretary of Transportation and when I see your delegation that serves you in Washington, D.C., what they're saying is we need these dollars to put Ohioans to work. We need these dollars to jumpstart our opportunity for high-speed rail, for more transit, for more highways. So every time I've been to Ohio, and I've been there many, many times, no one's ever said we don't want the money.
And yet that's all we hear at the State House these days. And I'm just wondering, hypothetically, if the state of Ohio turns down that $400 million investment, what happens to the money? Do they get to spend it on something else?
Well, I don't know which $400 million.
I mean, in the high-speed rail, not the $50 billion, but
okay.
Yeah.
Look, there is a national high-speed rail program that calls for over a 25-year period, 80% of America being connected by high-speed intercity rail. Ohio is a part of that national plan. Look, elections come and go. It took us 50 years to build the interstate system. There were lots of elections. Eisenhower signed the bill, but we had lots of presidents after that. This is a national program. A national program cannot be stopped by one election or one politician. If that were the case, the interstate highway system would have never been built because there were some states, you know, where a few people decided they didn't want it. But because it's a national system, because Ohio has decided to be a part of it, because your government, your state government, your governor has put the money in as a part of the match, Ohio is going to be a part of a national system. And that's the way it works in this country.
When the Eisenhower system went in, weren't there some states, though, like particularly the Carolinas, that weren't interested? And didn't that set back their development many years?
Today, the entire country is connected by a state-of-the-art interstate system, thanks mm-hmm. to the foresight, ingenuity, and to the taxpayers of this country who put forth the money. You know, look, at in the beginning, there was some controversy, but today America is connected by the interstate. 25 years from now, notwithstanding any election that will be held in any state, notwithstanding any politician who decides that they don't think it's a good idea, this 80% of the country will be connected by high-speed intercity rail. This is what Americans want, because when Americans go to Europe and they go to Asia and they ride the high-speed rail, they come back to America and say, why don't we have it here? Because we've never made the investment. Well, President Obama, Vice President Biden, and this Department of Transportation has made a huge investment, which will continue until we complete the high-speed intercity rail, which Ohio will be part of.
One of the biggest critics of high-speed rail, the passenger rail project, it's called, of course, 3C Rail in Ohio.
Right.
One of the biggest critics loves European rail systems, loves it. We'll go on and on and on, and he'll tell you all about how many times he's been there and how much he loves it. But he says it can't work in the United States because there's not the volume of ridership that there would be in, say, a Europe or, say, on the eastern seaboard of the United
States.
That
was the same excuse that people used about, you know, not wanting the interstate system. Look, if you build it, they will come. You build a road, it creates a whole economic corridor for jobs, for businesses, for small businesses. You build a bus system, people will use it. You build light rail, people will use it. You build it, they will come. People will use it. That same argument is as old as the interstate system. And it doesn't work. That argument just doesn't work. It really does not comport with the facts. You look at the interstate system. Look at the jobs that were created in building it, and look at all the businesses that are located all along the interstates in Ohio. That will be the same kind of economic corridor that the three C's create.
Tell us a little bit about, as far as the new proposal, the $50 billion per year, six-year proposal, calls for a permanent infrastructure bank. How would that work?
Well, that's a proposal that a lot of people have been talking about. The infrastructure bank would be created through the sale of bonds, and you'd create a pretty large pool of money that currently does not exist, and you would use that money for big, significant projects around the country. And it's another way to fund big projects, like big bridge projects or interchanges at interstates that need to be redone. And that pool of money doesn't currently exist. So the Highway Trust Fund is deficient. I mean, just because people are driving less and driving more fuel-efficient cars, and that's the way we funded the interstate system in America. So we need to create other pools of money, and the infrastructure bank would certainly be one that would allow for states to tap in for big projects.
We have time for a phone call, and George, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
You know, I love listening to these model railroaders whine because we don't have this. Amtrak costs this country millions every year, and nobody wants to ride it. And this will be the same thing. And CSX, who's in the railroad business, will tell you that this will not work, and it'll cost millions, and it'll be a big failure. It's just not going to work here.
Thanks, George. That's pretty typical, Secretary LaHood, of the criticism we hear in Ohio. The freight lines don't want it, and Amtrak's already losing money.
Ridership on Amtrak is at an all-time high, particularly in corridors where they have improved service, and it's very affordable. You know, look, when you do big things, and we do big things, there'll always be naysayers. There'll always be those doom and gloom people who don't, you know, want to make progress. I'm glad those folks did not prevail when we wanted to build the interstate system. And they will not prevail when it comes to development of high-speed intercity rail. It's coming to America. These transportation trains are coming to America. There's no stopping this train. It's on the way.
How much do you think support or at least ridership would depend on the price of gasoline in the United States? Big difference between that in Europe.
Well, look, at the price of gasoline is determined by the cost of a barrel of oil, mm-hmm. and where we get our oil from, and you know, and where it's refined. You know, that's how a price of, you know, a gallon of gasoline is determined. You know, we get, you know, the lion's share of our oil comes from other places outside the United States. And so, you know, we're subject to the whims of what's going on other places in the world. And we do have some refining capacity here, but, ridership, doesn't determine the price of a gallon of gas.
No, I know. I mean, how much would the price of a gallon of gas determine ridership? In other words, right now gas is down a little bit. It just popped up again, but it's been down compared to 2.5, 3 years ago when ridership went up, at least on the local buses here. Now that's down again. So the cost of gas drives ridership.
Look at people. People are looking for different forms of transportation, just simply because they want to get out of congestion. For one thing, that's why people like light rail or buses, or in some instances in communities, where they have the opportunity to, in Washington D.C., where they have a very strong metro system, you don't need to own an automobile. And so I assume the price of gasoline does dictate, at some point, how far people are going to drive or where they're going to drive. But if you have many different forms of transportation people can afford, then people will use them.
Ben, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Secretary LaHood and Ann. My question is, I understand that other states have successful state-supported rail programs. And I know that in Ohio, one of the main things rail critics have brought up and questioned is the speed of 3C. Do these other states with successful rail programs, do they travel at comparable speeds to what 3C will travel at?
Well, if you ride along the Northeast Corridor from Washington to New York, there are many different stops along the way. And we're not developing high-speed intercity rail so that you can go fast on a train. We're developing it as a form of transportation to get cars off the road and give people alternative forms of transportation. And it also is the connectivity. Ohio is a part of a national plan that you can get on the 3Cs and go from Cleveland, Columbus, and Cincinnati, but there'll be connectivity to other states and other parts of the country also, which currently, just simply doesn't exist. So, the idea that the 3Cs isn't going to go 200 miles an hour, again, is a bogus argument. The part of it that's important for Ohio is that you will be connected to a national system. You'll have a form of transportation that you currently don't have. It'll become an economic corridor for jobs and economic development, and it's a part of a new vision for transportation.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. I was basically just wondering because I agree. It seems like a bogus argument that because I know other states have rails that are successful and annually increase their ridership. But they travel at, the same speed that 3C will. So the notion, that 3C isn't going to be fast enough just seems
erroneous. Yeah, look, if you take the train from Washington to New York, you stop in Baltimore and you stop along the way in New Jersey and in Philadelphia and so forth, and it's some, you get up to 150 miles an hour, but in some instances where you're going to slow down pretty quickly, you don't get there that fast. But if you talk to anybody who uses Amtrak along the Northeast Corridor, it's comfortable. It's efficient. It's a good form of transportation other than thinking of having to go through the hassles of going through an airport to get on the shuttle or driving your car. And that's why ridership is up.
Okay. Thanks to Ben for that question. Secretary LaHood, you're going to be in Akron this week?
I am. I'm going to be in Akron, and I'm going to be with Betty Sutton, and we're going to be looking at some corrosion facilities there, and so I'm sure we'll be talking about other kinds of transportation too.
Oh yeah. Well, thank you for joining us today to talk about transportation.
Take care. You too.
U.S. Secretary of Transportation Ray LaHood. We're going to have to take a break. When we return, we'll be talking about that deal that was cut on animal welfare issues earlier in the summer and what's happened to it now. Stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
This is WOSU 820 NPR News. And tonight on WOSU, hear the two major party gubernatorial candidates in a face-to-face debate. Democratic incumbent Ted Strickland and Republican challenger John Kasich will debate tonight at 8. Listen live on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Support for WOSU comes from the Physicians Free Clinic and Voluntary Care Network, providing charity medical care for Central Ohio's uninsured patients. More about joining the Columbus Medical Association Foundation and supporting the clinic is at goodhealthcolumbus.org.
And you're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. It's 67 degrees in downtown Columbus at 11:22 this morning. Sunshine later today and a nice day with a high of 78. A few clouds tonight, a low of 52. Another nice day for Wednesday, sunshine and a high near 80. All Sides continues on WOSU 820. Thanks for joining us.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Last July, Governor Strickland took credit for brokering a deal between big agriculture in Ohio and animal rights groups that had planned a ballot fight to reform the livestock industry as they saw fit. Turns out that the state director of the Department of Agriculture, who heads Ohio's new Livestock Care Standards Board, said he takes the elements of the deal as just suggestions. We invited anyone from the Strickland administration to join us today on this program, and we were told that only the governor may speak about the administration on live radio. And guess what? We can't get the governor today. He's preparing for a debate tonight with his challenger John Kasich. So we are lucky. We have today talking with us Jack Fisher. He's executive vice president of the Ohio Farm Bureau Federation. Jack, welcome to the show.
Very happy to be here.
Nice
to see
back.
You again.
Yeah.
And glad to be on the air with Wayne Pacelli again.
Yeah, and Wayne Pacelli, president and CEO of the Humane Society of the United States, with us as well. Welcome back, Wayne.
Thank you. Good to be with both of you.
Okay, so let's hear from the governor in this clip from an ONN report. We hear Governor Strickland announcing the agreement about livestock care standard at the end of June, just before the filing deadline, which kept the Humane Society of the United States measure off the November ballot.
I am pleased and proud to announce today a joint agreement between Ohio's agricultural leaders and the Humane Society of the United States.
Governor Ted Strickland, flanked by representatives from Ohio's agribusiness and the Humane Society of the United States, announces a last-minute deal that prevents what could have been a very costly showdown between the two groups this November.
I think what we have concluded is something that is good for Ohio agriculture and will be good for animal welfare in our state.
Wayne, when that deal was announced in June, you were poised to file about 500,000 signatures for a petition issue on the ballot asking voters to decide whether to ban or restrict some big farming practices. You backed off the ballot issue after that deal was cut. What about the deal at the time convinced you to back off?
Well, let me say, and that we really never like to do ballot measures. They are very costly. They provide uncertain outcomes, and you know they can be very polarizing. We always prefer, in even the toughest of questions, to deal with our political adversaries and to work toward common goals. The best outcome is always when adversaries turn into allies, and I was thinking that we were headed for the ballot, and the governor kind of pulled us by the scruff of the neck and sent us down, and Jack Fisher of the Farm Bureau Federation and the other leaders of the major commodity organizations were present for all these discussions, and I think Jack and I would both agree that they were tough discussions. We were far apart in some areas, but that at the end of the process, we got something that is, Governor Strickland says, is good for animal welfare and it's good for Ohio agriculture. And I was concerned because for really the analysis that we have done of all the state animal welfare policies put Ohio 45th of 50 states. Ohio has been lagging on a wide range of animal welfare issues, strengthened anti-cruelty provisions of the law, animal fighting laws, exotic animal ownership, mm-hmm. as well as confinement practices on large farms. And we feel that this eight-point agreement, where all of the signatories, from the governor to the Farm Bureau to the Ohio pork producers to the Humane Society of the United States, are all moving forward to push ahead these eight reforms, is a really good outcome. And, you know, change happens through really surprising pathways. And I think this was a surprising pathway for our supporters. I think it was surprising to, you know, some farmers throughout the state. I know Jack has gotten an earful from some farmers. I've gotten mm-hmm. an earful from many of our members saying, well, you know, why would you deal with these guys? And my response is, I deal with them because they're the ones who have animals. And if we can forge solutions, that's exactly what we should be doing at the Humane Society. And we didn't get everything that we wanted, and that's the nature of a compromise. But we got a lot for animal welfare, and I think Jack and his partners in agriculture got more certainty in the immediate future, and we're all looking toward a better way to have outcomes in all of these realms.
But now the governor's director of agriculture, Robert Boggs, is saying, well, he just sees a lot of that stuff as suggestions. He doesn't feel as if there's a mandate for him to pursue those with the board, which he is ahead of.
I think that you know, sometimes people you know, are quoted in ways that don't truly reflect their opinion. And I think that there's a sense that all of us felt that, you know, we're not trying to impose all of these standards immediately on the Ohio Livestock Care Standards Board. And I think that what Director Boggs was trying to convey is that ultimately the decision rests with them. But obviously, when you have the set of actors who've come to the table and made this agreement, all of the leading agriculture commodity groups in the state, not only the Farm Bureau, but the pork industry, the poultry industry, the Cattlemen's Association, even the corn growers and the soybean growers were all at the table. Plus, you have the Humane Society and the primary members of the coalition that we had formed for Ohioans for Humane Farms. And then you have the governor who makes 10 of the appointments to the 13-member livestock board, and the director of the Department of Ag is the chair. Mm-hmm. I think that we're going to get there, and I think that Director Boggs is committed to getting there, and I know that Jack is committed to getting there, and we're certainly committed to getting there, and I'd be surprised if we didn't have the right set of outcomes, because it's just good for Ohio. It's good for all of the different groups, because we have found a way all to be comfortable with this, and it really propels forward animal welfare in Ohio, which unfortunately for a variety of reasons has lagged behind other states.
So are you saying that Director Boggs is saying that he's been misquoted by the Columbus Dispatch?
No, I think that what, again, Boggs can speak for himself.
Right. They won't speak. But go ahead, Wayne.
Yeah, I'm just trying to interpret what I think happened.
They've been invited to speak, however.
I think what happened is, and I know that Jack, you know, has said things in the press, and I've said things in the press, and I think that we're all trying to strike the balance to say that, hey, you know, we're not just saying, hey, this is a dictate. You must do it on the livestock board. And to take away, you know, any discretion. They've got a process. We want to respect that process. We want to respect the process that's going to be ongoing. We hope to address subsequent issues that are inevitably going to come up before that board. That's why Jack and others advocated for it, to have an ongoing mechanism to deal with animal welfare issues on an ongoing basis. So I think that it was really, rather than saying, okay, the board must do it, I think, you know, we're saying these are recommendations, but I'm confident that Boggs and the administration are very committed to it, and I'm confident that the Farm Bureau is committed to it, and I can tell you that we at the Humane Society are deeply committed to these outcomes.
That's Wayne Pacelli of the Humane Society of the United States, where he's president and CEO, and also with us, Jack Fisher, executive vice president of the Ohio Farm Bureau Federation. When Director Boggs called them suggestions, these elements, these provisions in this eight-point agreement. Was that your understanding, Jack, that they were always just suggestions and they'd be kind of pounded out over time?
Certainly. A key point for all of us to reflect on is that we've established by a ballot initiative a year ago, issue two, that created the Livestock Care Standards Board, a governance model that we think works extremely well for the state of Ohio, Ohio agriculture, and indeed for Ohio's consumers. And Wayne and myself and the rest of the steering committee, as we talked about this, we wanted to commit to and protect the operating authority and integrity of this Livestock Care Standards Board. So Wayne has publicly, and he did at the press conference, and he's done so again here today, recognizes this as the governance model, how we're going to debate, discuss, and move forward with animal care standards in Ohio. And so the board is expected to do its full due diligence. We have openly discussed and committed to say, these are some of the things that we think you should look at. These are some of the things that are going to come to your agenda and raise them as a priority levels. But certainly all of us will participate, will give you input, but the decision making rests with the Ohio Livestock Care Standards Board.
Wayne, before this agreement, was there a question whether these issues would even come before the board? Was that the problem, that you didn't feel like you'd even get a hearing and the due diligence of the board to study the issues?
I think that our concern was that the board really, and, you know, Jack and I and the rest of the commodity groups have had some really good dialogue, and I think that you know, we're dealing with each other straight and honestly, and I think we're all committed to having solutions, but we do have disagreements. We believe that the Livestock Board, as a body that was created through Issue 2, was kind of designed to thwart the ballot initiative that we had, and we felt that the composition of the board was going to be stacked against these reforms, and with the relationships that the agriculture groups, the trade groups have had with the individuals on the board, we felt that they would follow the recommendations of the trade organizations and oppose the ballot measure and all of its component parts, or at least most of them. Perhaps they would have done some of the humane euthanasia standards and maybe even some of the downer provisions, but we felt that when it came to confinement systems, they wouldn't do it. That's why we decided to proceed with the ballot measure. Now, ultimately, you know, what we wanted to do was not only pass those provisions by initiative, but we were going to direct the board within 6 years to phase out these confinement systems. But we hoped that it would send a signal to political leaders in Ohio that the people of Ohio care about animal welfare, and they want to balance economic considerations with animal welfare, and that the composition of the board would reflect the diversity of Ohioans' views on animal welfare issues, and the members would not just be drawn from the agriculture community. Now, again, there's nothing wrong with representation by the ag community on the board. We just felt that it was going to be that the ag community is going to be overly represented on the board, and there wouldn't be enough sentiment from people who felt differently on some of these issues. And that's why we decided to proceed with the initiative.
Wayne and Jack, do you pretty much agree that Governor Strickland is a pretty important player in this agreement?
Well, I think the opportunity for the governor to reach out to both the Humane Society of the United States and the Ohio agricultural community is important for a lot of reasons. Mm-hmm. And he was the facilitator in getting us the opportunity to sit down face-to-face and discuss these issues. Ohio agriculture is the state's number one industry. And at a time when the Ohio economy is looking for ways for all types of economic development, protecting the base, one out of seven jobs are related to our industry in the state, is on everybody's mind. So we appreciated that the governor recognized that and wanted to work with the ag community. And I also appreciate the fact that he had an awareness of HSUS's determination to change some of the animal welfare scenarios here in Ohio, and recognizing that. Isn't it interesting that all of us expect the Ohio General Assembly, the Congress, the Senate to in a very constructive and civil way, sit down and talk about issues and work them out. That's what we did.
Well, except that we're just about, you know, a month and a half away from an election. And, you know, Wayne, the governor's not doing too well in the polls. Now, a heck of a lot could change before Election Day in November, no question about it. However, it's not like he's a shoo-in at this point. And how much does the success, the ongoing success of this agreement depend on Governor Strickland retaining his office?
Well, I think that the agreement was really built around an end of year time frame for completion, and we all knew that the governor was going to be in a competitive election, and you know, we felt that, you know, these issues are pretty clear, and there's a pathway forward for each of the eight issues, and that it could all be accomplished by the end of the year. That's the agreement that we struck, and I really want to echo Jack's comment. You know, there is so much division in this country, and so many people feel that government is broken at the federal level, at the state level, you know, even, you know, sometimes at the local level. And there's such a polarization. And here we have forged a new pathway to sit down, you know, and adversaries who, you know, had pretty hot rhetoric about each other. I mean, the Farm Bureau said some tough things about the Humane Society, and we've said some tough things about them. And we were able to sit down and, with Governor Strickland's leadership, get this done. It would not have happened without his leadership. He obviously cares very deeply about Ohio agriculture and considers Ohio agriculture a very important industry to the state. And that was a big driver in his thinking about this. He also has a solid record on animal welfare issues. You know, he comes from a congressional district that has a lot of cockfighting, and for years he's spoken out against that issue, and he was a strong advocate of animal welfare policies when he was serving in the Congress. So I think that he, you know, was probably torn. Again, I can't get into his head. I'm just speculating.
No, neither can we, but go on.
Yeah.
I digress again.
I think that he was pulled in two directions. You know, he's concerned about Ohio agriculture, and he was worried about the ballot measure, and he was also, you know, cognizant that animal welfare matters, and I think he thought the measure would pass, and that this was a good way forward. And I, for one, really appreciate his involvement, and I appreciate the involvement of Jack and all of the other leaders in agriculture. We sat down and worked through some really tough stuff, but I think in the end we're all going to be the better off for it. And it was a good outcome.
We have to take a break. When we return, we'll get to some of those calls and a few more questions for Wayne Pacelli of the Humane Society of the United States and also Jack Fisher of the Ohio Farm Bureau Federation. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer. He's written a new book about what the Supreme Court does and why he interprets the Constitution as a living document, as opposed to the view of originalists who see the Constitution as fixed at the moment of framing. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes. It starts at noon right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. In public radio, listener feedback is very important. Your thoughts on the conversations we've been having across the radio and web matter a lot to us. So NPR is partnering with WOSU to create an online audience advisory panel, and we're looking for your help. Go to wosu.org/survey, and there you can sign up and send us your thoughts. It only takes a couple of minutes. wosu.org/survey.
Support for WOSU comes from Thrifty Airport Valet Parking, a valet service for business and leisure travelers that takes you in your car to curbside check-in at Port Columbus, 614-237-5800 or thriftycolumbus.com.
It's 68 degrees in downtown Columbus at 1140, sunshine later today, a high of 78, a few clouds tonight, a low of 52 degrees, sunshine and another nice day tomorrow with a high of 78, and then there's a good chance of rain looking ahead to Thursday. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is WOSU 820 NPR News. Mm-hmm.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guests are Wayne Pacelli, the Humane Society of the United States, and also Jack Fisher of the Ohio Farm Bureau Federation. We've got some calls. Let's see. Let's get started right now with Terry. Terry, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hello.
Hi.
Over the last 30 years, I have never missed a legislative hearing regarding several of these different issues.
Is that because you're a farmer?
That is because I am a farmer of sorts and a former member of the Ohio Farm Bureau. I no longer am because I feel that the Farm Bureau sold us out. But these measures that Mr. Pacelli is talking about are not good for Ohio, and Governor Strickland went against the will of the people when he jumped into this. And it's no mystery as to why he did. He wanted conservative farmers to stay home because they would probably come out and vote for Kasich. Now, for the last half dozen or so years, Mr. Pacelli's attempts to push these measures through the Ohio legislature had met with the legislature dividing hearings up to opponent's testimony and proponent's testimony. We have never, ever even gotten around to proponent's testimony because the legislature is not buying Mr. Pacelli what he's selling. He has no credibility with the Ohio legislature. He has no credibility with most Ohioans. And that's why these measures have never succeeded in Ohio.
Let's hear what Jack Fisher, is that your sense? I mean, obviously you've been at odds with the Humane Society of the United States before, but can you respond to what Terry's saying?
Well, we have to remember that certainly HSUS and Wayne and his board, Wayne and his constituency, they have a different philosophy about animal welfare and where we should move to as a society than, say, the Ohio Farm Bureau, the Ohio agricultural community. And so we come from different positions, and we recognize that, and we're talking about that. Today, to find solutions to the animal welfare questions that we think better serve all of us, it's about risk management for both, the use of our resources. It's the opportunity for Ohio farmers to continue to stay in business and fulfill their commitment to feed the world. We are working to the middle to try to solve these tough issues.
And let me, if I may, and you know, there are dare to say extreme voices on both sides, folks that don't want to see progress, who, you know, think that progress on animal welfare is a capitulation to HSUS, and there are folks on the other side who think we sold out to the Farm Bureau. And you know, for the gentleman who said that these issues haven't progressed, you know, he's right. The legislature has not advanced these measures, which is precisely why we turned to the ballot initiative process. Frankly, the legislature hasn't addressed a lot of issues that are even much simpler moral questions than the issues of confinement agriculture. Ohio is one of the states lagging in having felony-level penalties for illegal cockfighting and banning possession of animals for fighting. This is not a matter where the Humane Society's view is out of step with the people of Ohio. We've done surveys time and time again that show the people of Ohio are with us on that. They're with us on puppy mills. And frankly, the people of Ohio were with us on these confinement practices. Now, Jack and his team would have mounted a very robust campaign and would have made, you know, their arguments against the measure very forcefully and, you know, persuasively to a segment of the electorate. At the end of the day, I was confident that we were going to win, but I wasn't certain of that outcome. Mm-hmm. And I also knew that we were going to have to deal with the legislature, we were going to have to deal with the livestock board, and we were going to have to deal with the Ohio Farm Bureau and others. And I would prefer a pathway where we can talk through these issues and figure out a pathway forward. And I do want to say that in terms of our capabilities, you know, I don't want to be boastful, but we have had an excellent record. We have put three measures on ballot similar to the one that we were proposing in Ohio, and each time we got larger margins of victory, first in Florida, then in Arizona where we got 62% of the vote, and then in California where we got 64% of the vote on a similar measure, and one in the major agricultural regions of California. A lot of people think of California, San Francisco, and L.A. Well, we certainly won those areas, but we also won in San Joaquin County, and we wanted Kern County, which is the top Republican-performing county and one of the top agricultural counties in the state. So I think that you know, whether it's been our banning cockfighting in the states where it was legal or addressing puppy mill issues, we are right in the mainstream of thinking with Ohio voters on these issues. And the fact that folks stymied legitimate mainstream reform efforts in the legislature doesn't mean that our views were not consistent with the views of the public. It just means that people were able to bottle up reform. We see that in Washington. We see that in Columbus. We see that all across the country. A handful of lawmakers can block popular reforms, and that's exactly what happened in Ohio.
Okay, Terry, thanks for your call. 614-292-8513. And Al, you're on the air. You're a large animal veterinarian. Welcome to the show.
Yes, I'd like to review the history a little bit. You may say the United States went to the legislature in 2009 and tried to develop bills and pass as laws, and the legislators are really afraid of this sort of thing because they have a split electorate. Some people are much for it, some are against it. So they did the easy thing. 60% of each House, the Senate and the House of Representatives, voted to put it on the ballot. I was much for this because I think this is a good way to regulate agriculture.
Having the livestock standards board. Yeah.
Right. And I helped Pat. I worked very vigorously to help it be passed. And I believe in it. And there are people on there that are consumers, and there are people that are humane advocates and whatnot. Now, I attended one of the working sessions where they're talking about the confinement of calves and so forth. Mm-hmm. And it went on for 2 hours. I stayed for a little more than an hour just to sample what was happening. These people were diligent. They were working. They were just getting down to the T's and the I's. And I was a little distressed because the next day there was an article by Humane Society of the United States saying that they weren't doing a good job, but they didn't have anybody there to have input. The other thing that really worries me about these nonprofits is for Humane Society of the United States, I believe, has about 10 million donors, and PETA has about 32 million. Well, they are totally unregulated. We don't know how they use their money, but I have a fairly good idea of how they do. I have never given money to any nonprofit, even when I agree with their causes, because I hate to see the people that run them make a lot of money.
Okay, Wayne.
Well, again, I think it's important to deal with these issues. You know, people have these thoughts. These are not unique thoughts that people have, but sometimes these thoughts are just, you know, based on false premises or have false information. PETA, again, I'm not representing PETA. I have no association with PETA. I hardly ever talk to the organization. Doesn't have 32 million donors. It has a fraction of that. The Humane Society does have 10 million supporters. And,
but supporters don't equal donors, right?
Yes. No, these are donors, yes.
Okay,
all
right.
We do have. They're not all members. Membership is one time within a year, 25 and up. But we have smaller donors than $25 who are donors and supporters. But the issue of the livestock board, you know, the gentleman said that we criticize the workings of the livestock board. I must protest. I don't think that we have. We're obviously monitoring things very carefully. One of our representatives, our state director, Karen Minton, tries to go to as many of the meetings as possible. I believe she's been to almost all of them. I made a presentation to the members of the Livestock Care Standards Board. I haven't had the pleasure of meeting all of them, but I have spoken to a number of them. And I can say that when I addressed them, they treated me with great courtesy. I spoke with a few of them, and I'm really hopeful about having a strong working relationship, and we're careful about how we talk about them. And as Jack said, when we announced the agreement, the 8-point animal welfare agreement, I said that we were prepared to work with that livestock care standards board, and I'm going to honor my word. We're going to continue to do that. That doesn't mean that if they make a wrong decision that we're not going to, you know, criticize it, but, you know, we're going to commit to the process. I work in Congress or the state legislatures. I'm committed to doing it. Doesn't mean I always agree with everything that they do, and that's the nature of it. Now, on his comment on nonprofits, I don't think he represents the call or a mainstream view on that. There are more than a million nonprofit charities in America, and these groups provide an incredible range of services privately to help our civil society. And whether it's animal cruelty or whether it's promoting agriculture or promoting the arts or helping the poor or children, the nonprofit network of organizations is robust and it is critical to our society. If we didn't have these groups, our society would be much less than it is. And the philanthropic spirit of Americans is an incredible one. It's unique in the world. And I am so proud of the nonprofit sector. That doesn't mean that every nonprofit honors the highest standards all the time, but by and large they do. And there are standards. The IRS regulates nonprofit charities. All of them file, if they're of a certain size, reports that are called 990 reports. Mm-hmm. Many of them, like HSUS, provide annual reports as a supplement. Our work is transparent. You can see just about the entire range and breadth and depth of our programs by going to our website, humanesociety.org. And that's true for so many nonprofit organizations. So I'm sorry that the caller had such skepticism about the nonprofit sector, but I think it is one of the hallmarks of our American society.
Okay. Thanks, Al, for that call. And Jack, did you want to respond?
Well, indeed, the Ohio Farm Bureau Federation is a nonprofit organization made up of memberships. We operate on a membership basis. And in light of what Wayne said there, we are very democratic in terms of we're a representative system of governance within the Ohio Farm Bureau, as they are within HSUS. And we work very hard to engage folks to participate. The real value of a not-for-profit and the value of what they can accomplish is by the number of people who participate and give of their time and expertise. And so, yes, there's always things that we have to work on and that we want to be very transparent about and deal in a democratic way, but volunteers move America.
You know, Jack, last June, when the agreement was announced, you told the media that some farmers wouldn't be happy with the deal. And sure enough, some farmers are not happy with the deal. And that you were concerned about some of the things agriculture gave up. Can you reiterate what it is agriculture gave up?
Well, when you look at our industry of agriculture, and we're particularly focusing on the production of livestock that we're raising for food, these systems that we put in place, and particularly as we're focusing on in this agreement, housing agreements, these have been developed and put in place over a long, long period of time in a combination of farmers and the agribusiness industry working together for both efficiency and the best way to do things. These practices are a product of our land grant university system, the research arm of the American food system. And so we're very protective of these because we think they are the right things to do. We've gone about it putting them together with a lot of collaboration. And so that's why we challenge Wayne and HSUS on some of the things that they would like to do. We think differently about it.
Okay, we have time for a few more questions. And Julie, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. I just have a couple questions. One, I know that sometimes it takes a long time to get issues through the legislature. I want to know how long did it take to get this livestock care standard board issue on the ballot? And then my other question is, and that would be probably to Jack Fisher. My other question is really, first of all, I really do respect both Wayne Pacelli and Jack Fisher for forging the agreement with the governor, but I want to know what possible rationale could the Livestock Board have for rejecting recommendations put forth by the very own peers from leaders in the ag community and the Ohio Farm Bureau.
Okay, so the first question is, how long did it take? And, of course, the legislature really only dealt with it for a few days. It went through the legislature like grease lightning, as far as
wow.
I can remember. Right, Jack?
Well, after we had some meetings prior to
right.
that when Wayne and some of his team met with the ag community in Ohio. So there were discussions going on.
About the board being –
Well, about the issue of the animal welfare issues.
Okay. I thought you were talking about
– And from that, the Ohio ag community chose to take a proactive approach and work with the governor and the General Assembly to create the Livestock Care Standards Board. And so we, in Ohio, you can either do that by collecting signatures or go through the General Assembly. And we went through the General Assembly to put it on the ballot.
And they acted darn fast, Julie. Now, you said your other question was what rationale could the Care Board have to reject the recommendations of their peers?
Yes, but I do want to comment just on that. If it went through so fast, I know there are bills that have taken years to get through. So I was really surprised that something could go through both the House and the Senate so quickly.
Yeah.
But again,
this is Wayne Pacelli. I don't think in that case this was a model of deliberative action. I think that it was, you know, Jack and his team, are very adept politically, and they have.
That's a compliment, Jack, right?
Yeah. Thanks, Wayne.
It is, yes. Please take it as a compliment. You know, I wish that we had the cachet in the legislature that Jack and his team do, and they moved it, very fast. And, we were really in an adversarial position at that point. And then, but again, it did have to be approved by voters, and voters are very smart about these issues. And we didn't mount the big campaign against it. We knew that we were going to, we weren't happy about the confinement systems going forward, and we felt that the board would not address these issues, and that's why we pushed our ballot measure. But, as Jack has said many times, there is a real opportunity for this board to really dig in and look at these issues and assemble expert opinion. The legislature deals with so many subjects, they often don't dive deep into these questions. And while I do believe in the legislative process, and I do believe that it shouldn't just be people within industry or with a vested interest in matters that should decide all the issues, I do think in this case, the livestock board with the right composition and with the right people balancing all of the interests can really move things forward positively.
That's all the time we have. Wayne Pacelli of the Humane Society of the United States, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And also Jack Fisher, thanks for joining us again as well from the Ohio Farm Bureau Federation.
My pleasure.
I just want to remind our listeners, if you like this conversation, if you like what you heard today, we'd like to hear about that. If you didn't like it, we want to hear about that. You can go to WOSU.org/survey and tell us what you think. We're looking for a listener advisory board, and it's a project that we're doing with NPR, and a lot of it focuses on All Sides with Ann Fisher. So I'd appreciate your input. Go to WOSU.org/allsides and let us know what you think about the program. That's all the time we have today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is listener-supported WOSU and WOSU HD 820 Columbus and streaming on the web at WOSU.org. WOSU 820 NPR News.